Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, best-selling author and journalist Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we once again prepare to dive into the crypt and unearth another story for your ingestion. This week we will be continuing our look at Roche Terrio and his anthill kids. Before we get going, however, as always, we have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow me on social media, just search for The Deathcast or Ian Totten Author. If you'd like to sign up for the show's mailing list, just go to CorpseCreekPublishing.com. And if you enjoy what I do, please consider leaving a 5-star review wherever it is you get your favorite podcasts, liking the show on said platform, and sharing the episodes on social media. I know it's a bit of an abbreviated opening this week, but it is what it is. Alright, with all of that said, get yourself something to drink, find a nice comfortable chair, kick back, relax. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. When we left off last week, Roche Terrio was serving a prison sentence of 2 years for negligence leading to the death of a 2-year-old child who was the son of two of his followers. And Roche's followers had followed their messiah to Quebec City, where they had taken up residence in 4 apartments in order to be closer to him. Many people believed that Roche getting sent to prison would really be the end of his cult. However, as discussed last week, it was in fact not. He still kept in regular communication with those who followed him. And upon being released from prison in February of 1984, he very quickly reestablished his dominance over this group. Roche's followers wanted to stay in the city. This is, you know, easy to understand. They had been living within the wilderness for a number of years prior to his incarceration. Now they're in the city. They want to be there because it has all of the things that they need. Roche, however, was not interested in this. It's pretty easy to understand why. If they're in the city, then it is much easier for authorities as well as the families of his followers to gain access to them, something that he cannot have. So Roche ends up convincing them that they're going to go back into the wilderness. They settled in an area known as Somerville Township, which is near Lindsay, Victoria County, Ontario, Canada, which from what I could find was an abandoned lot in this Somerville Township. One of the ways that Roche was able to get his followers to do as he said is by claiming that he had given up the drink for good and that there would no longer be any of the violence that there had previously been. Once on this lot, Roche, who began referring to himself by the anglicized version of his name, Rock, quickly set about getting things going for this new community, and he really showed his ingenuity. He set up what has been described in some articles as a sawmill, which was basically a chainsaw attached to a snowmobile engine and various bicycle parts so that the wood would feed itself into the blade of the chainsaw. He also went a little further. This particular commune was an upgrade from their previous one. Some accounts have it that they actually implemented a water mill of some sort using horses to draw the water from a nearby creek into the commune. And they also built a two-story house, as well as an A-frame, which I imagine would have been for communal gatherings or possibly for when he was lecturing. And the men and women who followed Rauch at this point, they were really hard-pressed because all of this was done during the summer months. And because the mosquitoes were so bad, they were forced to wear sweatshirts and long pants in order to keep the bugs away. So they're out there, they're sweating like animals, working themselves to death. Rauch has no desire to do anything other than supervise and fornicate with his various wives. So he is continuing to give his followers new responsibilities, such as the fact that all of the children were now the responsibility of the women. On top of that, he kind of orchestrated a social pecking order within the group, placing Maurice Granier as the lowest person within the organization. Some accounts have it that Rauch, in fact, encouraged her husband, Jacques, to beat her. He's also known at this point in time to have forbidden a couple from sleeping together, going so far as to force Maurice and the two children that she'd had with Jacques to live in a separate building on the compound away from the rest of his flock. And I have to imagine that this was a way to try and break her to his will, as we already know that Rauch is really the whole reason for this is he wants to sleep with all of these women and control every aspect of their lives. I imagine that Maurice, even though she'd been with the commune for some period of time, was still resistant to this because she was legally married to Jacques. So you gotta imagine that despite what all of the things that her supposed messiah is telling her, it's not sitting well with her, so it was probably a maneuver in order to try and break her spirits and bend the woman to his will. We talked about in the last episode how Rauch kinda tried to build it into his followers' heads that they were God's chosen people and that normalized society would not understand what they were doing and in fact would rebel against his teachings. And almost as if to cement this idea, everybody within the commune applied for social services. Unfortunately for them, though, Quebec refused them any sort of assistance, stating that they were an entity and not, in fact, a family. Rauch used this to really dig into his followers that, hey, look, I've been saying it all along that they're not going to accept us and they're going to attempt to oppress us, and now here is further proof of this. And because of this, he decided that it was okay for his followers to go out and take what it was that they needed without permission. So now he's no longer promoting his old ideology of being a part of the community that they are in and trying to help those who come to them. Rauch is flat out saying, well, if society's not going to accept us, then we're just going to do whatever it is that we need to do to get the things that we need and or want from society. And eventually this is going to lead to Jacques getting arrested. On January 31st, 1985, and the officer, after making this arrest, quickly tracked down other members of the organization, namely Gabriella, Claude, Nicole Rule, and Rauch Jr. And upon searching through their belongings, it was discovered that they had stolen a little over $450 worth of goods. The sentence for this was that they were basically banned from ever shopping in the town of Lindsay again. This further drove a wedge between the followers of Roche and society, and he used this to his advantage, telling them that, you know, society's not going to help us, so our next step is we need to start hitting up members of our families, and if they refuse us, then that was just further proof of what he had been saying. And it's been stated that his followers did not want to reach out to their families because Roche had so warped their way of thinking. Their mindset was, why would I reach out to these people who hate me and don't want me to be involved in this beautiful, wonderful thing that I have discovered? But he was able to obviously get them to do this. And naturally, the families told the people who called that, look, if you leave that SOB, then yeah, we'll give you money, we'll help you out. But if you stay with him, we're not giving you anything. Now it's 1985, and they're desperate. They have no money, they have very little food, and Roche comes up with the idea of, well, we need to kind of go back to what it was we were doing in the beginning and start selling organic fruits and vegetables again. And it was from this enterprise that his commune got the name the Anthill Kids, because as Roche explained to reporters, they worked together like a colony of ants, and this proved to be fairly successful. So much so that Roche found himself now no longer struggling to make ends meet so that all of them could survive. He's getting bored, and we know what happens when Roche gets bored. He falls back on old traits, specifically on drinking, manipulating, and hurting those around him. And he began really manipulating the women inside of the group against one another in order to see which one was going to go to the greatest lengths to gain his favor. This is a pretty common tactic of cult leaders. I know to some extent Jim Jones pulled these types of things on his followers. Roche, however, had a much smaller commune and thus was more able to easily manipulate people's feelings and emotions against one another. But those weren't the only things that Roche did to pass the time. He began instituting nude wrestling matches between the women, obviously for his enjoyment, and on occasion he would get involved in these matches, with the stipulation being that if you scored a point against him, he would take that point out of your food ration. So basically, it was a, I'm going to hurt, degrade, and molest you in front of the entire commune, and you're going to lie there and take it. That wasn't the only thing that he did, though. There are accounts of him ordering the other two males from within the commune to stand naked, surrounded by a circle of the women who would hurl accusations and insults at the men before proceeding to beat them. So you can see he's, now that he's back on the drink, the level of depravity and violence is picking up once again, and it's really starting to escalate. And because they are so cut off from society, no one on the outside world had any idea that these things were taking place. So as the months go on, and these things are happening, there are spikes happening within the group where Roche begins to really go off the rails. There are accounts of him whipping various acolytes or hitting them with hammers. At other times, he would urinate on them in front of the others or force them to smear human excrement on each other. And there are also accounts of Roche taking two women off to the side and forcing them to perform sex acts upon one another for his enjoyment. And there was no complaining from his followers. They just did as they were told, because obviously Roche is the second coming of Christ, or whatever line it was that he was feeding them, and they were so cut off from society, so brainwashed by the things that he was telling them, and had been telling them for almost, you know, a decade at this point, they just went along with it as, this is what our Messiah wants from us. Followers have stated that really all of this type of activity followed Roche beginning to drink and getting drunk, and that the following day he would weep openly in front of his followers, begging God to stop using him in such a manner. But of course, that evening he would start drinking again, and the whole charade would begin all over again. At one point, he even went so far as to circumcise Jacques by cutting off his testicles and then refusing to allow the man to go to the hospital. In fact, every time one of Roche performed one of these surgeries or lashed out in the most violent of manners towards one of his followers, he would refuse to allow them to go to the hospital to be treated or to mend their wounds, and would instead insist upon his followers treating the individual with whatever prescribed remedy that Roche decided was applicable to that given situation. And that shows more than anything else just how morally defeated these people were, that they would allow this man to do these things to them and then callously allow, you know, other followers to come and treat them, even though their treatments really did nothing but put a band-aid on whatever it was that would ail them. One article I read recounts how he had slashed a member's jugular vein with a broken beer bottle, and afterwards they basically made a poultice and put it on the man's neck to stop the bleeding. And as the man begged him, "Why are you doing this to me?" Roche said something to the effect of, "The devil is in your blood and we need to bleed him out." The man survived and remained an ardent follower, but it really is telling as to how broken these people had become, that even these savage acts of violence weren't enough to force them to flee. And in fact, unfortunately, it is going to get a lot worse. On the 26th of September 1985, at roughly 9 a.m., Gabriella took a 5-month-old baby named Ebenezer, who was one of Roche's many children, and placed the child inside of a wheelbarrow outside. Temperatures were well below freezing when this was done, and it was also snowing out, so within a very short period of time, the child was dead. The reason Roche gave to his followers is that the child bore the mark of the devil and therefore had to be exorcised from their midst. Because of this, there is once again an inquest. However, Roche had the local coroner on his side, and the man listed the child's death as SIDS, which is sudden infant death syndrome. However, not everyone within the county believed this, and social services, along with numerous other government entities, began watching the organization to see what was going on there, to see if there was some way that they could break them up or take the children from them. some point in 1986, Maryse Grainger, if you'll remember from a few moments ago, she was the woman that Roche had ostracized from the rest of the Ant Hill kids, specifically because he wanted to break her so that he could have sex with her. She's still refusing his advances, so Roche and Maryse strike a deal. She can leave the commune and take the two of her smallest children with her. However, she will have to leave her oldest daughter there. The woman agrees to this. Obviously, if you're paying attention to what this guy's doing, you already know what his intentions for this oldest daughter was. Some accounts state that she had reached puberty by this point, others that she was nearing it. In any regard, Roche is intent on making this young girl his next bride. Out in the real world, Maryse struggles to fit in and find her way, and eventually she does. And it's because of this she's starting to get deprogrammed to some degree. She realizes, I should not have left my daughter there. I need to get her back. And Maryse decides that she is going to begin pursuing legal action against Roche. And part of this legal action entailed her giving detailed testimony. And this testimony had a pretty devastating effect on the Ant Hill kids, because with it, from the things that they learned, the province of Quebec is able to go in and take all of the children out of the commune. This was because Maryse had told them of the living conditions in there, the things that Roche would do and make the others do to one another, and she'd also alluded to the abuse that was taking place within the compound. So now they have the children out of there. Roche is continuing on with his normal MO, which is basically to state, you see, Maryse, she wasn't one of us. She was, you know, of the devil. She turned on us. You can see, I told you that people wouldn't understand the way we live and that they would be trying to destroy us. And here's further proof. They've just come in and they're trying to break up our family. Which further places his disciples under his influence. Not that they could be that much further under it. But to them, it was just a further testament of this man knows what he's talking about. He's speaking the word of God to us. Which, again, is a very typical tactic of a charismatic cult leader. They can turn things that others do into a perceived enemy strike against them, against that individual and the members of the group, in to destroy them. Unbeknownst to Roche, however, the state has taken all of the children and they have placed them all into various foster homes, and they're getting word back that a lot of these kids are having serious problems adjusting to the real world. But not only that, these children are displaying disturbing behaviors such as inappropriate touching and playing with their feces and being undressed, sitting there and rocking back and forth uncontrollably, all of which are telltale signs of serious child abuse having taken place. So the state starts questioning these children as to, you know, what has been happening to you, and they start learning just how awful life within the Ant Hill kids was for these children. The children were separated into two groups, those who had been fathered by Roche and those who had not been fathered by Roche. Those who had not been fathered by Roche were called animals, and they were treated as such. They were nothing more than slaves. they were rarely, if ever, allowed to eat, and they were forced to crawl on their hands and knees wherever it was they went. They were not allowed to walk upright like human beings. Adults were not allowed to speak to the children. The only one who was allowed to have any interaction with these children was Rook. The other children were treated a little bit better. They were fed somewhat. They were allowed to walk, but no one within the Anthill Kids was allowed to give these children any form of affection or warmth. Only Rook, who within the group is still referred to as Mose, was allowed to show the children any type of warmth. And all of them were subjected to extremely harsh punishments and really over-the-top chores. One instance states that children were required to take the women's sanitary napkins and wash them out by hand. And this part is gross. I have read at least one account where Rosh forced a child who had done this, who had not done, at least in his eyes, a satisfactory job of it, making the child drink the water afterwards. There were a lot of other issues with the children. They had no real medical care beyond what Rosh, you know, administered himself. They had never seen dentists, nor had they been taught to read or write in any manner. These children were being homeschooled, and now I'm using that term in the loosest form possible, because really all they were being taught was Rosh's particular religious ideology and that the outside world hated them. Authorities also learned that Rosh would perform blood rituals in front of the children, where he would sacrifice goats and chickens in an effort to appease God. And I want to give a trigger warning here. I know some of the stuff we've been talking about has been pretty disturbing. It does get worse in regards to the children, though. Some of the children claim that Rosh held basically orgies within the cabin, and that everyone was required to be involved in these orgies. And by everyone, I mean children as well. They told of being forced to masturbate Rosh, or of being raped by Rosh and Rosh Jr., and of being forced to watch as other members of the Anthill Kids masturbated one another or performed sex acts in front of the children. You would think that this would be enough for the government to step in and arrest everyone and break up the commune, but unfortunately that is not the case. Because after all of this has come out, the court overseeing it decides that we need an independent study of this thing. And what ends up coming out of this is a 300-page report where basically people are praising Rosh's unique and free-spirited approach to sex education and living. And the court actually orders the state to return all of the children to Rosh and the Anthill Kids. This is what in other contexts is referred to as a major systematic breakdown. When I covered Jimmy Savile, I used that term off and on when describing how the state discussed his supposed crimes. The state described the things that Savile had done, and the institution's reaction to these alleged crimes as a systematic breakdown with regard to protecting the welfare of the children. That this right here is the classic definition of that terminology. Because you have the children telling them these things. You have Maurice Grognard telling them these things. And the state still decides that these kids can go back and live with this within this commune. It's good for them. And I'm not going to get too far afield talking about this. There are other organizations that this has happened with. One of whom you may have heard of called the Finders. There were similar allegations made against that group. And the United States federal government just let them off the hook and let them go about doing their business. And this legal battle lasts for quite some time, with the state refusing to give up these children and launching their own report, which basically came back and refuted all of the things within this 300-page report. This is an effort by the state to pull these kids back from Roche, and eventually they're able to do this. This was in 1987. They're able to take the kids back and terminate all parental rights for everyone within the group. Basically meaning the adults can stay here and do whatever the hell they want, but you're not getting the kids involved with this. The report also lambasted everyone involved in the outside report that was commissioned after the children was taken by claiming that those involved were showing sympathy for the individuals simply because they were a French-speaking group within an English-speaking area. This is similar to how sometimes you will see an individual from a minority group go out and commit the most heinous of heinous crimes, and then certain members of society back them up and state, well, their ways are different than our own, and it's because of how they were raised, yada, yada, yada. This second report refuted that and said, regardless of how these people were raised or where they're from, wrong is wrong, and if they want to be a part of our society, then they need to at least embrace some of our societal norms. Not all of them, but some of them in regards to dealing with children and abusing them. This really throws the Anthill kids into a bit of turmoil, and Roche begins to seek outside help from individuals who have a somewhat similar mindset to him, who might be able to help him in his various legal problems. These are mostly with Mormon groups based within the U.S., and at least from what I've been able to uncover, while he did get in touch with some of these groups and became friends with some of the various leaders, it really didn't have a whole lot of effect on staving off the government taking the group's children. And it might be because of this that it's been said Roche's alcoholism really exploded at this period of time. And it was almost a nightly basis where he would punish someone for some perceived slight or offense to God. At one point, he ordered Claude Ouellet to tie a rubber band around his testicles and then parade around the exterior of the building until Roche told him it was enough. Fortunately for him, Roche ended up passing out, and when he came to the next morning and realized what he'd done, he had Claude take the rubber band off, but the damage had been done by then. And so again, Roche, being doctor, goes and performs a surgery using a straight razor to cut Claude's scrotum open and removing an infected testicle with his hands before cauterizing the wound with an iron. After this, Roche holds a vote to see whether or not Claude should be stoned to death for offending God. the other members of their commune voted against this, and Roch is said to have completely snapped at this point, threatening to burn Claude to death with an acetylene torch, at which point Claude was able to escape from the commune and hide out in the woods, which is something that other members of the commune had taken to doing as Roch's alcoholism had progressed and his actions had become more erratic. Roch's actions from this point on become erratic and more violent. He's known to have shot one member of the commune through the shoulder with a gun. He's also known to have thrown a knife into the leg of one member before going and getting drunk and falling asleep. And upon awakening the next morning and finding that a blood clot had formed, Roch began to perform surgery on the leg using a iron that had been held into the fire to probe the wound while pouring cup after cup of boiling water on it. When this did not help, and a few days later and the leg was becoming infected, he packed the wound with salt, olive oil, and spruce gum. Eventually, this woman's leg healed enough for her to be able to escape from the commune, but as had happened with other members, he was able to convince her to come back. He also enjoyed passing an acetylene torch over the body parts of members, burning them horrifically, as well as beating them with his hands and fists or hitting them in the side of the head with the flat side of an axe, pulling teeth out with a pair of pliers. One of the most famous known instances to come out of this period of time is Claude, who, if you'll remember, Roch had castrated. He angered Roch to the point that he instructed one of his various wives to break Claude's legs using a sledgehammer. Claude seems to have gotten quite a bit of abuse, more so than Jacques. It's been written that Claude was hung from a ceiling hogtied at one point for over an hour while the various women plucked out his pubic hairs one by one, as well as forcing the man to sit down on top of a lit stove and slicing his arm over open with a broken piece of glass. But his abuse wasn't limited to Claude. He also abused the women pretty heavily, as we've talked about already. Another thing that he had begun doing was forcing the women to stand naked in front of the rest of the commune while they were verbally berated, after which Claude would take a pair of vice grips and grasp the women's nipples until they bled. The list of atrocities that Roch perpetrated on his followers is never ending. Beating them with belts, cutting off fingers, cutting off the fingers of children, using a piece of rope in an attempt to rip a prolapsed uterus from a woman's body. Really, the list is endless. You can get an idea of what life was like within the commune come sundown once Roch began drinking. By all accounts, during the day he was at least somewhat cognizant of the things he was doing, and it was during these lucid moments that his followers would see the man that they had Fallen 4. Nightfall was a different story, obviously. And they began to fear these periods where Roke would begin drinking and lapse into, you know, his fire and brimstone testimony, followed by extreme acts of violence. I'm gonna read you a letter that one of his followers had written following one of Roke's outbursts. Just so you can kind of get an idea of the mentality of the people within the Ant Hill Kids. Quote, "Good day, Moses, my master. I would have liked to have talked to you yesterday evening, but I think it is preferable to write these things down rather than saying them for fear of talking too much. I'm going to talk to you about the last fit of anger that your master exercised through you. I really believe that what you did doesn't come from you, but from someone much higher. For my part, I really believe that you were possessed by a very powerful spirit. That's what I saw in what you did. The throwing of the knife, the rifle shot, the harm done to Mammy. My eyes saw things that went beyond them. My body is very much afraid of all these things. I understand it very well because of the law of death in which it exists. But within myself, I am well. I am very well and very happy to belong to a real master who himself belongs to only Master of Life. Love, Rachel." So you can see in that letter, the people under Roke's control, they're not holding him responsible for his own actions. They're dismissing them as having come from either God or some other outside force and entity, which further fuels Roke's feeling and belief in his own omnipotence. Sometime in 1988, the individual who wrote that letter, who went under the name of Rachel, began complaining of stomach issues, and Roke informed her that he was going to have to perform an operation. Eventually, he proceeds to get drunk out of his mind and then informs her that, hey, tonight's the night. Everybody, let's go into the kitchen. Some reports have it that there was some level of violence inflicted upon all of the women in the commune prior to what we're about to talk about, with some stating that he strangled each woman in turn almost to the point of unconsciousness, demanding to know whether they realized that he controlled whether they lived or died. In any event, he gets this woman, Rachel, into the kitchen and forces her to strip down in front of all the others, after which point she lies down on a table and Roche begins attempting to perform an enema on her using molasses and water. Apparently, whatever it was he was doing was quite painful, as this woman began losing control of her bowels, and Roach, in an attempt to calm her, informs her that, you know, it's okay, this is part of the process, do not be embarrassed. He then takes a tube and puts it down this woman's throat, telling the other members to alternate between sucking and blowing into this tube. Well, he goes and prepares to perform the actual operation itself. He began by punching her in the stomach as hard as he could, ordering Rachel to remove her hands when she attempted to ward him off, which she promptly did. After this, Roke took a knife and sliced Rachel's stomach open, just below the rib cage. After which he reached inside of this wound and pulled out roughly 4 inches of her intestinal tract, which he promptly ripped out with his bare hands before shoving the rest back in and informing her that she was going to be all right. He then orders the other women to stitch Rachel up. Once this is done, they all leave the kitchen, and Roke orders a hot bath be drawn for Rachel, which was said to have made her feel worse. So he then orders her to lie within in a cold bath and sends her up to her bedroom. You can see where this is going. Rachel does not make it. Lying in the bed, she begins bleeding from the mouth, vomiting up large quantities of blood and stomach acid, and dying. There are a couple different versions of what happened next. Some of them state that the final atrocities done upon this woman's body happened immediately following her death, while others state that it was only after Roke came back from Utah that he committed these final, almost necrophilic acts. And that's the line we're going to go down. After Rachel's death, Jacques became extremely despondent and attempted to kill himself on numerous occasions by drowning himself and overdosing on over-the-counter medication. And eventually it became too much for Roche, and he ends up traveling to Utah on October 16th of 1988, where he meets with a Mormon leader by the name of Dr. Jess Grossbeck. Grossbeck informs Roche that there was nothing he could have done to save this woman, and that in fact, she had died from a vein erupting inside of her esophagus. Roche then goes on to fill him in on this crazed dream he had wherein this woman had actually entered his body. And Dr. Grossenbeck convinces him that this is a sign from the Lord and that in fact, Roche has been impregnated by Rachel, a sort of reverse birth, and that he is carrying her child. And armed with this knowledge, Roche goes back to the commune and informs them of this before ordering that Rachel's body, which had previously been buried out in the woods, be exhumed. Upon exhuming her, they cut her body open and fill it with vinegar in an attempt to keep the worms away before burying her again. But that isn't the end, because a few days after this, the entire commune is mourning. Roche orders that she be exhumed once again. And it's at this point that he decides, I can bring people back from the dead. I have this power. And so using a hole saw, he cuts a hole into the decaying skull of Rachel before declaring that this will lead to her resurrection. Obviously, this does not lead to her resurrection. And once it becomes apparent to all of those gathered that she's not coming back, Roche is informed that Rachel had desired to be cremated, at which point the woman's body is set ablaze, and once everything is done, each of the followers take a couple of her bones, with Roche taking the lion's share, which he puts into a jar filled with olive oil. And it's been said that he would repeatedly masturbate into this jar in an effort to resurrect her from the dead. I have to believe that at this point he's suffering from delirium tremens, which is a symptom of extreme late-stage alcoholism, wherein the sufferer will hallucinate things having happened or happening, or that they have the ability to do things that normally they would understand they are unable to do. After this, the family pretty rapidly deteriorates, especially after Roche returns to Utah in the later part of 1988, early 1989, and ends up having a argument with Dr. Groebling. The whole reason they'd gone there is because one of Roke's many wives was pregnant, and they wanted to conceal this birth from Canadian authorities. Members of the group, though, saw Groebling stand up to Roche and had the realization that he's not all-powerful, although it was one of those realizations that took some time to foment within their minds. In the interim, they go back to Canada, and another one of Roche's infamous crimes take place. He ends up getting drunk, which is pretty much usual at this point, and all of the remaining members flee into the hillside, and Roke turns his attention to Gabriella. He demands that she put her hand onto a table because he's going to cut her pinky off. Instead, though, Roke slams a hunting knife through the top of her hand, pinning it to the table, and walks off to continue drinking. When he returns an estimated 45 minutes later, Gabriella is still conscious, although her arm has turned largely blue due to loss of blood. There's a lot of gruesomeness associated with what happened next, but the long and short of it is that Roke ends up amputating Gabriella's entire arm using a meat cleaver. She ends up escaping only to return and Roche to operate on her again. He also smashes the side of her skull open with an axe. Gabriella takes off and ends up passing out in the woods only to return a few days after this, at which point he takes part of a car which he heats in the fire and presses it into her various wounds in an effort to get the infection out. And this is really the final straw in everything. Because of this, because of the horrific abuse he had heaped upon Gabriella, she ends up taking off and finds her way to a hospital. And despite the fact that she gave a story about what had happened, the police decide, you know, this is enough. We need to go in and put a stop to this. So they head on over to the compound, only to find that it has been completely deserted. Everyone has fled further into the province of Quebec. So now the police put out this massive manhunt for every one of the Ant Hill kids that is still at large, and they catch up with most of them. And on October 6, 1989, Gazelle tells police about what happened to Rachel. And it can't be a coincidence, or can it, that as she's telling officers about this, they find him hiding out and arrest Roche. Eventually, everyone involved within the cult is sentenced to various degrees for the amputation of Gabriella's arm, but they weren't done there because by now they've found the body that's buried out in the woods, and eventually in 1993, Roche would end up being convicted of second-degree manslaughter and sentenced to life in prison. And one interesting piece from this, though, is even though the Ant Hill Kids had dissolved by the time he was convicted in 1993 and his spell over these young women had been broken, at least four of them continued to visit him while he was in prison for conjugal visits, and each one of these women ended up giving birth to another one of Roche's children. And as I stated at the beginning of the last episode, Roche Terrihue was found dead on February 26, 2011, murdered by his cellmate. While the rest of his followers have done their best to get on with their lives following their convictions and eventual release from prison, for the most part, they've done their best to keep a low profile and stay out of news stories. That is it for this week's episode. I hope you enjoyed this second part on the Ant Hill Kids. As always, if you enjoy this show, please like and subscribe wherever you get your favorite podcasts, and consider leaving a 5-star review. Until next time, The Deathcast is a production of Corpse Creek Publishing. Stay morbid! However, another story that came out from a commune member is that the boy was beaten, but he wasn't dead, his neck hadn't been broken, but that Roque, upon seeing this boy, who he considered an animal as he had not fathered the child, decided that he was going to perform a circumcision on this boy. And to do this, he used ethanol alcohol to sterilize the razor that he was going to do, but he also filled up a rubber bulb and filled it with this ethanol alcohol solution, squeezing it into the young boy's mouth as a form of anesthesia. And according to this version of the story, the child actually died from alcohol poisoning. After the child's death, his parents showed little to no emotion, and it was decided that this young child would be buried on the commune grounds over fears that animals might get to the remains. So they buried the remains and went back to things as they had previously been. Eventually, Roche, who was increasingly consuming alcohol, decided that Veer should stand trial for his crime, with various members of his extended family serving different parts within the trial. Veer ended up not being found not guilty by reason of insanity, but Roche was not satisfied with this judgment, and he decided that Veer should be castrated. After informing Veer that this was to be his punishment, and letting him know that he should sign a letter of consent, but, you know, they wouldn't complain should he not, Veer did sign this letter. The young man laid down on a kitchen table, at which point a rubber band was placed over Veer's testicles and they were removed. Amazingly, Veer survived this, although Roque was still incensed for some reason at this man and began tormenting him at every chance, beating him mercilessly whenever he could. This led to Veer escaping from the commune and heading to a nearby village, where he told authorities that a baby had been kicked to death by a horse. This led to Roque and the child, who's the child that had had his penis lanced by Roque, the parents ended up being arrested as well. It was at this point the police learned that Veer had beaten the child severely, and they also discovered the boy's body along with the letter of consent that Veer had signed. Roque and various members of the commune ended up being charged with negligence in regards to this young boy's death, and eventually all of them were found guilty. So Rock ends up getting basically 2 years in prison, while other members of the commune get various prison terms, and they are forced off of their land, which would later be raised by the local police department. So while Rock is sitting in prison, his followers move into apartments within Quebec City so that they could still be close to him. But as this is part one of a two-part series, you already know that this is not going to be the end of the group that came to be known as the Ant Hill Kids. And in fact, it's about to get a whole lot worse when we get into part two. I am going to cut the story off at this point. I'd like to thank you for listening and remind you to please leave a 5-star review wherever it is you get your favorite podcasts. Until next time, the Deathcast is a production of Corpse Creek Publishing. Stay morbid.